You ever watch this guy on television?
You all were not telling the truth, and you should not be trusted.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, thank you for what you did for your country tonight.
Be offended with the Democratic whip, not House Republicans.
Like a machine, Matt Gaetz.
Welcome to Hot Takes. This is Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk about the news. And the news out of Florida, failure to launch.
We continue to violate a couple different weather rules that we now do not expect to clear in time to allow for a launch today. We go ahead and end today's launch attempt. Launch control, if you would end the launch auto sequence and proceed into the launch abort auto sequence, please. Launch abort has started.
We're going to have a little bit of a delay in the SpaceX launch till Saturday as a consequence of weather. That's not something we're not used to. We'll get right back on the stick, and I look forward to it. But it does give us the chance on the podcast to talk a little bit about space and space policy, and specifically the way that this era of space exploration and innovation really has coincided with globalism and the consequences of that, and how President Trump has restored an America First approach even to space, and it's one that's creating a number of dynamic and really exciting results. I look at space oftentimes through the eyes of my parents. We as Floridians always get excited about a big launch, but particularly this era that needed something to captivate the national attention and raise our gaze and bring us this sense of great glory on Earth through achievement in the final frontier. You know, it's something that I think, you know, defined a lot of these boomers. And to see how excited my folks get when there's an exciting thing going on with space, or when they get to talk about where they were during the moon landing, and even during some of the great challenges and tragedies that we've had associated with the space mission. So, you know, it is, in a way, the generational passing of a torch with this SpaceX launch. Space going from something that was so linked to the public sector, the function of government to bring us to space and make us a multi-planetary species, to now something that is even a part of the canvas for capitalism and investment and innovation, the things that have allowed America to have the greatest prosperity here on Earth and will probably keep us prosperous no matter how many planets we land on. But in terms of policy itself, there are two truths that we must deal with. First, that the gap in capability in space has closed between the United States and other nations. And second, that this is now a contested domain. And I speak on these issues regarding space as a member of the Armed Services Committee in Congress. The Air Force, which has the largest Air Force base in the world in my district, has been really driving a lot of the military space mission. Now we have the Space Force, something that I think will elevate space as a strategic domain, something that happened under President Trump. But I get the chance to get a lot of briefings and information regarding what's going on in space. And so I'm eager to chat about my perceptions of those discussions. Space really has been dominated by globalist thinking. And in a way, it's easy to see why. From up in space, we all are, in fact, on one globe. But this rise in globalism in the 60s and 70s and 80s, where we gave away more and more of our sovereignty in the economy, in trade, and so many other ways, was also one in which we sought this global engagement, because the prevailing thinking on space was that it would bring us all together, that no matter how many fights we had here on planet Earth, if we could get up in the space station with the Russians, our nations would be cheering for us together, and that it would create a sense of common fate and common purpose, and perhaps make our conflicts on Earth seem a bit smaller. But in fact, what this did was limit the leverageability of the uniqueness of U.S. talent in space. I mean, we won. We won the race to space. Nobody beat us. And, you know, instead of trying to preserve and hone that talent as a uniquely American asset, well, we wanted to share it with the world. And we, in fact, did, I think, under the best of intentions. But the consequence was that other nations began developing competing programs, competing talents. And particularly in Russia, all of that talent didn't stay put. We've seen circumstances where Russian talent will pop up in Iran, in North Korea, in China, in other places where they've had varying degrees of success. And as a result of that growing talent base, there have been more international players able to assert some role, whether it is an ambition in low Earth orbit, whether it is an ambition in intercontinental ballistics and potential dual-use technology. There are a lot of satellite systems that have different types of capabilities. A satellite for us is a communications device, but imagine how for another nation, it could potentially be deemed as having both defensive and offensive capabilities and dual use, not only for the commercial sector, but for the military, intelligence, and strategic interests of foreign countries. And so we saw that that gap close as a consequence of the diffusion of talent, our exporting of those capabilities, and then that diffusing to places where the politics and the thinking on our country wasn't always in line with our best hopes and our most most austere dreams about how space would bring the world together. And as that started happening, really in the 90s was when we saw countries like China develop this this ambition beyond peace in space. But as a consequence of Clinton not wanting to engage in the development of that capability for our country, we lost that race to the initial thinking about space in terms of arms. And of course, there is no capability today that matches that of the United States. Just in terms of the thinking about it as a paradigm, I think we were limited by the Bill Clinton space doctrine. And so that brought us to the modern pre-Trump era thinking about space, and it was one that continued to have these globalist overtones that were not America first. We thought, well, in terms of low Earth orbit, we've kind of got that down, so we'll allow the Russians to do that for us. We'll pay them a lot of money to do it, and then that'll give us the chance to do thinking beyond just low Earth orbit. That is really a flawed doctrine that you saw really adhered to by the Obama administration, because what it does is it pours like $4 billion a year into Russia's space program. When you're hiring them to be your ultra high cost bus driver into space. And so that's money that instead of pouring into our economy, instead of using it for jobs for our people and to embrace and enhance the talents of our citizens and even our companies, we were putting that money in the hands of an adversary that had closed the gap and was viewing space as more of a contested domain. That then changed. And now we are seeing through SpaceX the opportunity for the private sector in the United States to be able to meet that challenge. And just what an amazing thing to build out our business and our industry and our supply chain and our people. And I think that how President Trump has oriented even space, something that you wouldn't really think an America first paradigm might apply to. I mean, President Trump has even applied America first thinking to space, and that has inured greatly to our benefit. Here's a great interview from CNN. I don't always quote from CNN or their interviews, but it's a former astronaut, Dottie Limburger, talking about the ways in which our departure from an embrace of Russia really matches up well with a build out of space as an incredible American advantage and something that we can take great national pride in. So it's CNN's Brooke Baldwin with Dottie Limburger.
Why is it important, to Rachel Crane's point a second ago, because the U.S. since 2011 has had to rely on the Soyuz, has had to rely on Russia to get up into space. Why is it so important that we, the U.S., can be self-reliant in spaceflight?
Well, one, it saves us money, right? And it also keeps our crew members from having to do so much travel around the world, so they can do more of their training back here in the United States. But also it brings engineering and science to our soil as well. So the talent pools that we see behind these companies of young engineers and aerospace enthusiasts, it's really important to keep that talent here in America as well. And for our students that are in university or themselves have dreams of flying in space or working for aerospace, it's very exciting.
And I just think it's something that Democrats spent like 3 years telling us that President Trump was acting as Russia's agent and at the behest of Russia when it was President Obama pouring money into the Russian space program. And now you've got President Trump unlocking what I really believe is an unlimited potential in countries like SpaceX and Blue Origin and any other number of entities that we may not even know of yet, that one day will help us go and achieve the greatest opportunities for humankind in the final frontier. I don't think we're going to get there by building up the talents of other countries and then having to fight with them in space. I think we're going to get there by betting on America and our people and our schools and our industries, and just as Dottie Limburger said, ensuring that we continue to be the greatest force not only on Earth but beyond. So the takes haven't just been hot. In at least a couple cases, they've been pretty right. I set up the discussion about FISA in episode 12, talking about how the president had until this point in time really relegated the management of this issue to Mitch McConnell, and that coming out of the Senate, McConnell had every Republican vote for this FISA bill except Burr, who wanted no changes to the program, but we have well detailed how maybe his perspective is not always the best. And then you had Rand Paul vote against it because he wanted bolder reforms. And I said that I wasn't voting for it because I did not think that it had the sufficient reforms in it, and I detailed the amendments that I thought were necessary to get us there. And then lo and behold, President Trump comes out just hours after we posted our podcast calling on all Republicans in the House to vote against this bill. I then predicted that there would not be the votes to pass it in the absence of the president's support in the House of Representatives. And we were on the floor of the House till like 9:30, 10 o'clock last night with Nancy Pelosi trying to scramble around and find the votes for FISA. And she couldn't do it. And they pulled the bill and the vote didn't happen. So my expectation is that, you know, we're going to continue to see the president demand the accountability in these secret court systems before there is any just blanket reauthorization. And in that regard, the president has my full support. Big tech and the special immunities they get that this podcast doesn't get, that your local newspaper doesn't get, that your CNN, Fox News, MSNBC channels don't get. That's right. Big tech was able to go get special immunities in the law. I went through those immunities in great detail on episode 12, Wednesday's episode. Today, there will be an executive order from the President of the United States that I believe will go right at those immunities and will expose the tech companies to lawsuits in the event that they engage in the type of interference that we've seen. And I'm not just talking about the interference with the president and his message. I'm talking about when they shadow banned me and Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes during the Russia hoax. So be on the lookout today for an executive order that will very closely trace the issues that were outlined in episode 12 of the podcast. And it is about time to create some accountability for these big technology companies who have benefited from the allegation to the government that they are a neutral, unbiased platform, but then they're never held to account. They never have to have transparency hoisted upon them so that we actually get to see whether or not they are an unbiased platform. And in Twitter's case, with the president, they have removed even the veneer of neutrality in their desire to castigate him and to characterize his comments as true or false based on their perceptions. And it's just frankly something that you wouldn't see out of a neutral platform. So that neutral platform status, that's what gives the big tech companies the liability shield. Way more detail in episode 12, but way more coming from the White House. Alex Leary at the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the White House is considering putting a panel together to review big tech bias when it comes to free speech. And so, heck, I'll make the case. Put me in, coach. I serve on the antitrust subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. I would love the chance to field the concerns of fellow Americans who want their voice heard, and I would like to demand the transparency from some of these technology platforms to see if they really are the unbiased, just nurtured marketplace of ideas that they claim to be. Because you know what? I don't think they are, and I think we can prove it. More to come. Super exciting opportunities. And I'm glad that the Trump administration sees that we got to get some young people involved in this discussion. I mean, look, we are the age of Americans, the millennials, Gen Z, who really, in for better or worse, conflate our real identity and our real speech in person with our digital identity and our digital speech. And then those things, in fact, become real. They become part of our experience and thus the American experience. And so the headwinds, particularly that young conservatives face online, are not going to be vanquished by the boomer generation alone. And I think that President Trump has inspired a generation of young conservatives. So let's get those folks engaged in talking about not just the gravity of the problem, but some of the different solutions we can use. And by the way, these should be solutions that work for people who are liberals, conservatives, libertarians, populists, Whigs, I don't care. We need fair, open, honest debate. We need to be able to confront each other's ideas. I think ultimately it's what leads to the best decisions in government, and frankly, the decisions we have to make in our lives. If our assumptions are challenged, if we have to think about them, that is a good thing. And the fact that a bunch of people in Silicon Valley think that they can define the truth for us is a fundamentally un-American thing. And, you know, for all the libertarians out there that would just say, well, if you don't like it, you know, don't use Twitter, don't use Facebook. Look, you know, I have libertarian impulses and tendencies. I don't want Washington, D.C. running my life. But I sure as hell don't want the folks out there in Silicon Valley running my life. And that's why I think we've got to enforce existing laws, and then we've got to make sure that there are not special immunities and privileges created by the government just for technology platforms under the lie that they don't put their thumb on the scale to direct speech one way or the other. Big news, can't wait for it. The death of George Floyd is obviously very tragic, and perhaps equally obviously was totally avoidable. And as I see these protests and riots in Minnesota, your heart breaks. And while I believe that protest is something as American as apple pie, the notion that people would think that looting and property damage and destroying businesses is an appropriate or productive way to exercise their frustration is just inaccurate. I mean, that is not going to build, you know, an opportunity for us to address these challenges, but they must be addressed. In the state of Florida, I served as criminal justice chairman when Trayvon Martin was killed, and it was hard to see my state go through that pain. Ultimately, you know, the facts bear out on these things, and you've got to view the facts and the circumstances dispassionately. But certainly, you know, the loss of life when you feel it's entirely avoidable is something that can get people quite exercised. So, you know, while I hope that we're able to have better training, I'm grateful that we have the ability, I think, to have a lot of eyes on these law enforcement events so that we're able to capture what occurred, and we're not relying on second and third hand or even first hand, you know, recollections that are just not as good as the video. And that's why I think the proliferation of body cameras has been helpful. But again, in this case, you know, nothing was helpful enough. Nothing that we've done was going to save this life, and it was snuffed away from us, and it appears it should not have been. And so I pray that there can be some comfort brought to those who've been impacted, but also that the way people express themselves does not have to do so much harm to others. Coronavirus has had a big impact on schools and learning. I had a great Facebook Live session with a school superintendent in my district.
In Okaloosa County, we have so much to celebrate when it comes to the success of our schools, the commitment of our teachers, the types of parents we have that, you know, when I come and do events for military academies or other school visits, there's always a batch of really involved parents that are there, and that has a positive impact on the teachers. And we wouldn't want to lose that sense of celebration, you know, and I hope that as we get going into this next school year, that we do take what we've been through as something that's made us stronger.
What I've done here in Okaloosa County is we've created a task force, and we're going to look at what are the challenges for the upcoming school year. We'll look at the CDC guidelines that have been put out in terms of reopening schools, but we'll also look at summer activities as well. So through this group, we'll make decisions. So for example, you know, what might a trip on the bus look like next year to school? What might the lunchroom look like? Social distancing in the classroom. So will we do virtual education, or will there be a blended model? So there's a lot of decisions that have to be made.
It was really interesting to go through that discussion. I encourage you to check it out. Really what I want to talk about here in a broader sense, in a national sense, is the debate that's been going on in our country about homeschooling, about digital learning, and the extent to which coronavirus has accelerated that debate and ripened some of the questions on each side for us to get into and evaluate. And, you know, as we answer these questions, it's important to understand how high the stakes are, because many experts are predicting, and even a lot of the frontline teachers and administrators and principals are telling me, we're going to have the summer slide on steroids with a lot of returning students. And, you know, if you've got students in some of those key grades like third grade learning reading, or in those middle school years learning the fundamentals in mathematics that are going to be critical for high school competencies and high school graduation requirements, it's absolutely essential that we are in the best position to deliver the highest quality educational content in a way that students will be in the best position to succeed. So I've always been a fan of digital learning. In the state of Florida, we've completely embraced it. We want to use our state as really a platform for great companies to come in and create digital content, and for homeschoolers or for students engaged in some blended learning between homeschool and a traditional education environment can access and learn. A lot of military students use this in my district. It's very helpful because they're coming in and out of a place where they might have had access to certain curriculum and they might need to do some remediation. So I've always been a big fan. Unions have always hated digital learning in the policy space. And, you know, I mean, some folks might say that's harsh or overgeneralizing, but look, here's the deal. Unions view the efficiencies of digital learning as a threat to jobs. They figure that if you can get, you know, one lecture that 200 students can go hear, then you don't need maybe as many teachers. And if you could do that at scale, that ultimately that's a threat to jobs. So it's just simply a you know, parochial economic interest for the unions. That's why they exist. So that's the fight that they're in. For me, though, the appeal with digital learning was the better instruction. I mean, why should some kid in, you know, the Everglades of Florida only be able to get the highest quality of education in the Everglades of Florida, you know? And by the way, if the best physics professor in the world is in the Everglades of Florida, why should students in my district not get the benefit of that? So I think that where we find effective ways to engage students on digital platforms, we should absolutely use it. The school and the school environment is not just about learning. I mean, it has an additional purpose. In addition to the school being the place that you send your kids for learning, it is also the place you send your kids. And I think that has become apparent to a lot of people, you know, who've reached out to my office. I mean, when I'm looking at the incoming calls we are getting with questions about daycare openings, about when's, you know, school plans for the fall will be revealed, I'm starting to see that, you know, in the American family today, The school is not just about absorbing the learning. It's a place to send your kid, for your kid to be safe, for your kid to be watched while you engage in your work. And by the way, you know, I get the argument people are making, well, parents are going to be home more. But yeah, like, look, a parent that is home working does not want to be home working with their kids sitting there in a lot of circumstances. I mean, I'm sure there are some fantastic parents that are able to juggle it all and do it all. But I know a lot of folks who are saying, look, yeah, I can stay home with my job and telecommute more, and I've probably learned that from the coronavirus. But the other thing I've learned is that I cannot be on my Zoom meeting while my 7-year-old is here, you know, wanting their next lesson in social studies and in, you know, their reading lesson. So I just think that we have learned, I think, to appreciate the fact that the school is also a place where kids go, and that is an important thing, not for every American family. Love the homeschoolers, love the successes they've had, but for a lot of American families. And while digital learning, I think, can improve the level of instruction, we see some limits to it. I don't think digital learning is ultimately going to unlock an experience where school is something that never exists, that students actually attend in the flesh, in person. I think that it will be a way within the walls of that school to enhance, build on, and refine the messages that are delivered and the ways in which the students can absorb the information. But I don't think a full-on replacement of digital learning is coming following coronavirus. Just my hot take for my constituents here in Northwest Florida. If you're enjoying Hot Takes with Matt Gaetz, make sure to subscribe, leave us a 5-star rating and review, and tune in tomorrow for more Hot Takes.